only on your station for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM, Washington.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington. And welcome to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station at 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. It's a pleasure to have you join us in this hour. We are part of the fulfillment of the station's mission to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. My thanks to you, both regular listeners and new listeners, new members of the station, who realize that we're entirely listener-supported. In the past 2 weeks, you have been generous with your financial support of the station, and for that, I thank you. And for those of you who may have not caught the last 2 weeks, whether it's this program or another, you still can donate at WPFWFM.org. Many of you, again, have been longtime listeners, and many of you have passed the word along for new listeners. I'm grateful when you support the station, both financially and socially. And remember, a large or small donation can go a long, long way, because together we can make a difference for everyone. 48 years, because you, the listeners, have continuously supported the station. And we will continue to have the courage to tell the truth about what's going on in the world, authoritarianism, displacement, apartheid, and genocide. And our commitment is to present jazz and public affairs through all its extensions, whether it's news, blues, hip-hop, house, or music from the world. WPFW will be your unwavering partner in the fight for social justice and the preservation of life and culture. Our topic today is counterculture, a story of America. American counterculture, through historical figures and movements, has redefined and will continue to define mainstream understandings of freedom, culture, art, and politics. To help explain that, our guest is Dr. Alex Zamelin. Dr. Zamelin is professor of Africana Studies and Political Science at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. His books include African American Political Thought and American Culture, The Nation's Struggle for Racial Justice, Struggle on Their Minds, The Political Thought of African American Resistance, Anti-Racism, An Introduction, Black Utopia, The History of an Idea from Black Nationalism to Afrofuturism, Against Civility, The Hidden Racism in Our Obsession with Civility, All Is Not Lost, 20 Ways to Revolutionize Disaster, and with Alex Olson, The Ends of Resistance, Making and Unmaking Democracy. His latest book, Counterculture, The Story of America from Bohemia to Hip Hop, is the topic of our discussion. And good morning, Doctor, and welcome.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
And may I call you Alex?
Of course. Of course.
Thank you. Well, there's so much going on, but two basic questions. I read that marvelous lineup of your corpus of work. I think it will give people an idea of what you do. But what's the mission of your work, and how does counterculture fit into it?
I think from the beginning, as I began to write and research, I was really fascinated by the ways that core figures of dissent and figures who were marginalized in American life, whether it was African-American political thinkers, women, those who historically have been dispossessed, how they tried to reimagine core concepts that we see in American life. And for me, that project was really fascinating, partly because in American society, there's this premium placed on ideas like democracy, equality, and freedom. And in America, these ideas are valorized. They're taken to be essential to who Americans are. And yet there's this tradition that runs counter to the mainstream that fundamentally transforms and challenges some of these core ideas. And I've always been fascinated by these counter traditions, and my work has been driven to explore them and bring them to life.
Well, to even go further, let's get right to it. Would you do me the kind favor to read the opening paragraph of your book? That will give us a sense of what you're surveying and what you're exploring.
Sure. In 1855, a Brooklyn-based 36-year-old carpenter and journalist, Walt Whitman, publishes a book that scandalizes critics because it is infused with a spirit of radical democracy. It is called Leaves of Grass. Whitman is inspired by a group out of New England in the 1830s. They are abolitionists, feminists, and free thinkers who advance a gospel of iconoclastic individualism. This group calls itself the Transcendental Club. In the first decade of the 20th century, an immigrant from Imperial Russia named Emma Goldman champions direct action. She is a revolutionary anarchist. Goldman inspires a group of intellectuals who call themselves village bohemians. They assault middle-class sensibilities and endorse left-wing politics. In the 1920s, a group of black writers aimed to change the meaning of race and American identity. This is known as the Harlem Renaissance. In the 1940s, a poet from Paterson, New Jersey, named Allen Ginsberg, wants to transform the denigrated into the sublime, his downtrodden friends into angels. They are called the Beat Generation. In the 1960s, Ginsberg becomes a hero for the new student movements who are fed up with war and capitalism. They call themselves hippies. One of Ginsberg's friends from his time in Greenwich Village in the late 1950s is a black playwright named Amiri Baraka. Baraka is less interested in personal liberation than in black liberation. In the 1960s, Baraka is at the vanguard of a black avant-garde that calls itself the Black Arts Movement. In the 1970s, a youth culture bearing witness to the destruction of racism, gentrification, and economic devastation in America is born in the South Bronx. It is known as the Hip Hop Generation.
Thank you. So listeners, if you've been carefully attentive, you've got a sense of the landscape and the people we'll survey. So yeah, I'm always minded to uphold some sense of media responsibility, some sense of public service journalism. And when we think about counterculture, I'm old enough to remember the conjure that's delivered to us through mainstream media are, as your introduction included, hippies, yippies, the Summer of Love in the Bay Area of California, Woodstock, anti-war protests. But it's more than that. Some say that at least for America, it begins with the Transcendentalist. And it feels like even, especially that particular movement, was really mindful of that there's going to be a forward thrust of legacy into the future. So let's try to get a basis of like fundamental understanding. Like we've said in part who the fundamentalists are, but what are some of the dynamics? What are some of the elements that revolve around counterculture?
Yeah, so I too, when I began writing the book, thought about my understanding of the counterculture, which I think, as for many of us, is connected to the 1960s. But then, as I began to read more deeply and research more thoroughly about the long history of the counterculture in America beyond the 1960s, I discovered that there was a kind of central preoccupation. And what I recognized was that that preoccupation was trying to square the difference between personal freedom and collective freedom. And of course, we, on an intuitive level, understand this distinction. Personal freedom means we do what we want to do as long as it doesn't harm the abilities of others to do so. And collective freedom means all of us collectively have basic resources to exist in the way that we'd like. The counterculture tries to turn this idea of personal freedom, radical personal freedom, free expression, individual choice, radical individualism, in a way that doesn't conform to pre-existing standards, but crucially connect this idea of individual freedom and individual awakening to collective liberation. And this is important because not simply does the counterculture desire a kind of engagement with the collective, it desires collective liberation. Now, throughout history, we see different conceptions of what that might mean. In the 1850s with the Transcendentalists, that means an abolition of slavery. It means first wave feminism, the incorporation of women into the franchise. In the 1960s, that means more economic justice as post-war capitalism has developed and spread its tentacles in American life in ways that were unprecedented. In the 1960s, it too means an end to war and the threat of nuclear collapse and catastrophe. So the core dynamic within counterculture is this attempt to champion personal freedom, artistic expression, with a kind of commitment to collective liberation.
So reflecting back, freedom to do something, freedom from something, but most importantly, synthesis, antithesis here, a revolutionary freedom. We're free to do these things with some sort of purpose to change the world and possibly make it better. I think that captures it. Fortunately, there's always a counter reaction to such things, and people in their humanity offer opportunities either for a counterattack or somebody just plainly disagrees and gets malevolent about the whole thing. So when we hear that I want to be free to be who I am and do what I want, we have to hear that with careful ears, don't we? We have to understand context. No matter how unique a group or an individual thinks she or he is, we have to pay attention to that quite carefully, I guess. At least that's what I'm surmising from your book. Why don't we do this? There's going to be two approaches in talking to you, Alex. One is to just do the touch points of individuals and events and places.
Sure.
But the other is to really capitalize on these themes. Let me remind listeners before we go further that you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, I ask that you put your focus on the topic and guests at hand. Our topic is counterculture, a story of America. To help us understand that, Dr. Alex Zamelin, who's the professor of Africana Studies and Political Science at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and the author of Counterculture, The Story of America from Bohemia to Hip Hop, is with us. Yeah, let's start out with this exciting figure, Walt Whitman. Tell us a little bit about him, and I'll probably ask you a few questions along the way.
Sure. As many of your listeners are familiar with, Whitman historically is considered to be one of the great American poets. He's from Long Island, spends a lot of his youth in Brooklyn, and becomes affiliated early on with the earliest iterations of Bohemians. There's a bar, a Bohemian bar, in the 1840s known as Pfaff's in the Bowery. And Whitman very much engages these figures. He goes to drink with them, he banters with them, and he becomes a part of their culture. And their culture is irreverent, it's sarcastic, it's critical. At the same time, it's also a political culture. Many Bohemians at the time are critical of racism. They're critical of slavery and racial enslavement. They're critical of US empire. As Whitman moves forward in his career, he starts to recognize that the way to become a well-known poet is to engage in self-branding. So what we see throughout is that this figure who's canonized begins to engage in early acts of social media promotion. He writes ghost reviews for his work. He begins to circulate copies of Leaves of Grass to influential people who we call influencers today. And slowly he becomes part of the mainstream, partly because he begins to write poetry that glorifies the nation, glorifies national reconciliation. And it's only then when Whitman starts to be seen as the good gray poet, as he's remembered in death. And so the pattern that we see with someone like Whitman is a young Bohemian who's engaged in questions of critique, of resistance, slowly becoming institutionalized, precisely because he champions certain ideals that are important to the ruling elite.
And not to, I have a bad expression, chicken peck at things. But again, you mentioned that he had a sense of style and flair, which he sartorially displayed.
Right.
He's a colorful figure, you know, basically making his living as a carpenter.
Correct.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the carpenter is a poet, of course. The other thing, though, is, and we'll begin to see this in different figures, some are more consistent than others. That's not a moral judgment. And some have paradox and contradictions. So, for instance, he had public and an overall commitment to abolitionism. But there's some questions about his whether he was a racist or not.
Right.
You know? So the last point, that, and this is a question, not a statement, what is the context of being part of the Village Bohemians? How does this term fit in for us American folk in our history?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to recognize this is a constant theme throughout the book, and that is the ways in which the commitment to revolutionary freedom, as I describe, has unexpected results or consequences. And often it leads figures into alarming directions. So for instance, in his quest to promote himself and be ingratiated in the eyes of the American public, Whitman begins to celebrate Andrew Johnson, who is the most rabid white supremacist in power, of course, the president at the time who succeeds Abraham Lincoln. At the same time, he pens essays that are incredibly racist. So there actually is very little question about Whitman's own allegiances, especially later on in life. And we see this kind of dynamic where those in the counterculture may have certain ideas about liberation, but in their personal attitudes and their worldview, sometimes there's a fundamental contradiction. To your second question about the role of village Bohemians, we hear the term Bohemian and we associate it with those who are the epitome of cool. We think of hipsters, we think of those who are artists and so on. Bohemianism actually comes from France in the 1850s. And it, again, never has a clear structure beyond the fact that it is a kind of general opposition and revolt to middle-class sensibility. However, in the 19-teens and 1920s, there is a group in the village that come to be known as the Village Bohemians. These are figures like Max Eastman. These are figures like Emma Goldman, who's an anarchist. This is a place of radical experimentation and expression, art, music, culture, and Village Bohemians are decidedly socialist. And this is important because in the 1850s, when Bohemianism comes to American shores, it doesn't have a coherent political ideology. By the 19-teens, partly because of the First World War, partly because of all the developments in American society, there is a specific ideological flair to Bohemianism, and that is socialism. Some of the great Bohemian literary magazines, for example, The Masses, are explicitly socialist. They engage in questions of class, economy, imperialism. Moreover, Bohemians are multicultural. One of the great Bohemians is, of course, Langston Hughes, who moves from Bohemia to the Harlem Renaissance, but nonetheless retains his left-wing ideas in the 1930s when he defends the Scottsboro Boys and is very much involved with socialist and communist politics. So there is a deep connection between Bohemianism as it's understood in the 19-teens and 1920s and a kind of multicultural ethos that extends to the Harlem Renaissance and later, as we'll discuss, to the Black Arts Movement with figures like Amiri Baraka.
And perish the thought that I'm going to hold this up. I am very anxious to get to a closer time. But you, in your book, you do mention some of the social experiments, whether they're from Bohemian movements proper or a socialism of a different sort. And both pre-Civil War and after, these are great social experiments, for the most part, that fail either because of some internal inconsistency over race or gender or public scandalization and attack. But let's not delay, at least before the break, let's begin to look at Emma Goldman, often commonly called through her subsequent history, Red Emma. And if the folks in Baltimore are listening, that's a shout out to the bookstore of the same name. And that's just my tip of the hat to that community that listens and supports WPFW. Emma Goldman, tell us about her.
So Emma Goldman was an immigrant from Imperial Russia, a Jewish person. She came to the United States as a teenager, partly to escape a loveless marriage and to kind of pursue the dream of America, as many immigrants at the time. As soon as she arrived, she was quickly disappointed because what she saw was massive inequality, racism, poverty, and a general imperial sensibility that was xenophobic and hostile towards foreigners. And so in many ways, Emma Goldman, who is rightly considered one of the great early feminists and social activists, began to advocate for this ideal of anarchism. Now, we think of anarchism as a society without government, but Emma Goldman at the beginning of the 20th century had a very specific understanding of what anarchism was. And that was a critique of all forms of organized inequality, whether it was an equality that came from the state. She was deeply critical of the police and the military, an inequality that came from capitalism, or an inequality that came from hierarchical and organized religion. And so Goldman saw anarchism not so much as a defense of a society without government, but a critique of all the inequities that society exhibited, and specifically the ways that it impacted those who were disenfranchised and marginalized.
And needless to say, from your vivid description, she was quite intellectually informed. She did reflect the work of forebearers in her own convictions. Mm-hmm. There's another aspect of her. She's, you know, all these figures that are in this book, you've really accentuated their humanity, their personal qualities in a very good way. She was very much her own person. She took the ups and downs of life's experiences. And from what I can see, you give evidence that it always pushed her out into service to others, mm-hmm. whether one agrees with her or not. It seems that it always pushed her out into service of others. And again, moving quickly before our break, she's just such a fascinating historical figure. And you mentioned a number of things. She runs into a man, Sasha Berkman, mm-hmm. and they're quite a team. So I'm mentioning him to bait you to talk a little bit about him.
Okay.
But also, like Whitman, she understands that there's a public life and that the public life can help be the wherewithal that supports her financially. Mm-hmm. In other interviews that I'm privy to that you've done, you also talk about her aesthetic, her sense of joy. She's known at these social parties, which you can tell us about, for doing the anarchist slide.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that makes Goldman such a fascinating person, David, is those contradictions that you mentioned. On the one hand, she is an outspoken feminist who speaks about reproductive rights at a time when it is quite dangerous to do so. She supports figures like Margaret Sanger, who pioneers contraception and birth control. And
to the point of eugenics.
Exactly. And there's a break between the two as Goldman starts to recognize that Sanger, like Whitman before, wants to have more of a public profile, and in so doing aligns herself with the eugenicists. But what is fascinating about Goldman is that she has a really complicated personal life. She has this fraught relationship with a man named Ben Reitman, who's a doctor in Chicago, who's an activist, but who is also a womanizer and who really, in many ways, challenges her conception of sexuality and gender and living in a particular kind of relationship. And Goldman still, despite these personal contradictions, still wants to maintain a certain image of herself in public because she recognizes that the public persona is important. And yet, what is also interesting is that she makes certain private things that she cares deeply about into public questions. For instance, as you alluded to, she loves to dance. She loves to do the anarchist slide. Now, in traditional movement circles, joy, dance, expression are not really at the center of conversation. Instead, we talk about strategy, we talk about protest, and so on. Well, Emma Goldman wanted to bring that sense of joy to the streets. She famously said that she would not want to be part of someone's revolution if she could not dance in it. And I think that's an important sensibility which we see throughout early anarchism, including, for instance, Lucy Parsons, who is a Black anarchist living in Chicago in the 1880s. She famously is married to Albert Parsons, one of those who was martyred during the Haymarket Massacre in the 1880s. one of Lucy Parsons' goals is to throw what she calls monster picnics, where all the folks from the community gather around on a particular day. It's a large barbecue, and essentially there's a mixture of joy, fun, extracurricular activity, as well as political conversation and engagement. So there is this central theme, not only within early American anarchism, but throughout counterculture generally, to connect the personal, the life of the mind, joy, and public expression and collective action.
And on that note, we've got to the halfway point of our show, so we're going to take a little break, Dr. Zamelin. We're talking to Dr. Alex Zamelin. He's a professor of Africana Studies and Political Science at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and the author of Counterculture, The Story of America from Bohemia to Hip Hop. We're at the halfway point of this topic and show. As we usually do at this point, we bring you public service announcements. So I ask you to stick with us, and we'll be right back after this.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Dr. Alex Zamelin is talking about Counterculture, A Story of America. And this is one of the examples of programming that we bring to you here at WPFW. You just heard the promotion of One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. That is a special, mark your calendar, on Saturday, March 8th, starting at midnight. In other words, Friday night and all day Saturday, you will hear presentations from women that everyone should listen to, whether it's music or information. We look forward to that. And thank you for supporting us in that project and other offerings that we do here at WPFW. Again, Alex, it's a pleasure to have you this morning and to making the brash statement that both Whitman and Goldman have the hustle. Either they had to or they had the hustle. And people who know me from listening know that I knocked the hustle. So I'm trying to take it easy. Are there any last words about Emma Goldman?
It's important to recognize, and you know, we've been trying to stress this throughout the conversation, is that there's a kind of long history and continuum. For example, Emma Goldman's journal, which she publicizes and publishes, called Mother Earth, the initial title is supposed to be called The Open Road, an homage to a Whitman poem. Later, Langston Hughes sees Whitman as one of his great inspirations. At the same time, Langston Hughes sees Emma Goldman as a great inspiration. So there's this kind of long history and a conversation which too often is ignored in the way that we think about these figures. And I think it's important to recover.
Yeah, I'm glad you're saying that, because we think of these things kind of Gnostic, kind of esoteric, kind of hidden within elites. Mm-hmm. But little do we know, we are, dare I say it, fated creatures of the efforts of what people freight up throughout history.
Right.
A little punning and going on there. I'm sorry. We're going to get to James Weldon Johnson in just a moment. I guess I want to do a marker with you. We're beginning to notice, particularly not only through Emma Goldman's influence, but that places of learning happen both in the streets and in more traditional formalized institutions. It's the end of the 19th century going to the other that I believe they call Ferris schools, something that your book introduced me to. And you also point out some historical figures that are in the Ivy League universities. And as I'm reading that with readerly interest, I'm going, uh-oh, it feels like here's a similar situation that feels like the present.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure where we should go. There's a little juncture here between education and the arts. I think James Weldon Johnson, in some ways, resolves that for us.
Mm-hmm. So James Weldon Johnson is well known, I think, for being the author of the famous autobiography of an ex-colored man. And at the same time, James Weldon Johnson is a teacher. And the reason why he comes to New York to be part of the Harlem Bohemian scene, along with his brother, Rosamond Johnson, both of them are classically trained musicians, is because of a white supremacist attack on them as young black men living in Florida. They're both teachers, and essentially there's a massive fire that burns throughout Jacksonville where James Weldon Johnson is a teacher. And not surprisingly, this fire prompts a certain level of chaos and disorder, which inevitably, according to the forces of white supremacy, is blamed on black citizens. So Johnson himself barely escapes a lynching, as he puts it, and this becomes the basis for the autobiography in many ways, this important novel.
And just to give listeners an idea of when this happened, this was around May 1901,
yeah,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and what is also, I think, telling is that Johnson himself becomes part of the Harlem Bohemian scene at the beginning of the 20th century, where he sees his life as an educator to be connected to a life of music, a life of Broadway performance. And later, of course, he becomes famously the first black secretary of the NAACP. So we see this remarkable life, a teacher, an educator, the first secretary of the NAACP, a bohemian.
And also, let's not neglect that he and his brother wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Correct. That's right. That's right. Which I think is also important because in line with the general theme of the book, how the counterculture tries to push against the culture, you see figures like James Weldon Johnson, who throughout his life is wrestling with a way to create an alternative language, a new music, a new anthem, if you will, to what it means to be American.
You know, it's funny, even up to this point, and this will be more salient later, if we can just step it up and finish and I don't get in your way. The difference with these black countercultural movements and the white or majority culture ones is a different sense of grappling, sometimes reconciliation, sometimes not, of both patriotism and a very healthy form of nationalism in regards to the preservation, striving, and thriving of black people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Johnson certainly epitomizes that. So you talked about the Harlem Renaissance, and it's going to launch us into the other periods of the book. Listeners, I promise we're going to do our best here. There's a certain section that I asked you to read in preparation. Why don't you go ahead and do that, and that will give us a sense forward.
Sure. If you walk through Harlem in the 1920s, you would experience a feast for your senses. On the intersection of 125th Street and 7th Avenue, along the well-paved and well-lit streets, you would see residents in their best clothes going to the Lincoln and Crescent Theater. On Sundays, they'd be leaving the 160 churches in the neighborhood, among which the Mother AME Zion Church was the most notable. There would be parade processions teeming with auto horns and sirens. Marchers would be doing the cakewalk with their batons swirling and white plumes flitting in the air. On one corner, there might be a mourning procession for a funeral. Across the street, an impromptu religious sermon. You would see devotees of Black nationalist Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association heading into its headquarters at Liberty Hall. The 135th Street branch of the New York Public Library in Harlem was not only a grand container of the written word, it was a marvelous stage for public lectures. The topics included the political philosophy of Karl Marx and anti-slavery activism before the Civil War. The YMCA and YWCA organized debates between Democrats and Republicans there as well. On the same street, the well-known socialist Hubert Harrison set up the Institute for Social Study, where he spoke on Darwin, Lenin, Empire, and Third World Solidarity. In New York, the city that never slept, the underground was wide awake at night in Harlem. Number runners who handled tens of millions of dollars every year would be standing alongside hustlers. Jazz musicians would jam their saxophones right next to the easels of painters who would sit quietly beside the trolleys while motor cars sped by them both. At a time when electrification wasn't widespread, ice dealers on summer nights would be jockeying for commercial real estate beside the shoeshiners and bootleggers who were running the speakeasies during the era of prohibition. Through the half-open apartment windows, you would smell oxtail stew and sweet potatoes being prepared for rent parties or buffet flats. Harlem was the center of Black cultural production in New York and increasingly the US. But Harlem was no utopia. It was, after all, a part of America where racism was lurking beneath the shadows.
So that is the challenge to the counterculture. And people rise to the occasion in being themselves, but also being in relation to others. So we began to mention Langston Hughes a little bit. What an incredible figure. I think of him as one of the ultimate Black writers of self-initiative. And there's a reason I'm saying that, because as he's growing up and coming of age, he does amazing things, which really develops himself as a person, but also his career.
Mm-hmm. Langston Hughes, again, and this is, as I point out, a theme, is in many ways someone who strives and engages in a kind of creation of the self without any clear expectation of what it might be. He attends Columbia University as a young man for a little bit, beginning to study engineering, but quickly drops out because he's fascinated by the theater and he's fascinated by art. And so he begins to write and is introduced to W.B. Du Bois, who again is an important figure in Black history at the time, a famous Black sociologist. And it's with Du Bois's help, as well as the help of others, that Hughes goes on to the literary scene and begins to publish poetry and essays. And what's remarkable about Hughes is that throughout his life as an artist, as a thinker, Hughes is always trying to carve out this space between expressing himself individually as a kind of individualist in the transcendental tradition, while at the same time having a serious social conscience. This means that he is at the forefront of civil rights. For instance, as I mentioned, he is a prominent defender of the Scottsboro Boys. These were young Black men who were falsely accused of engaging in sexual violence in the South. And Hughes, in addition, wants to set up a theater. It's called the Harlem Suitcase Theater, which tries to perform and create socially conscious plays. At the same time, Hughes is involved in politics at a moment when it seems like socialism might be a viable alternative to contemporary American life. Hughes jumps in to the fray and tries to promote certain economic egalitarian ideas. So with someone like Hughes, and again, I think this is crucial to remember for your listeners, there are the kind of public narratives of specific figures in the counterculture. Hughes, of course, is canonized and lionized for being a wonderful writer and poet. At the same time, his life was one of social activism. And that part, I think, is often neglected.
It's a shame, but I think I have to do something dutiful here. So we're in the midst of the Harlem Renaissance. Your book talks of the significance of the blues, Ma Rainey and her relationship to Bessie Smith. This period seems to be both profoundly personal and individual, but again, the social impact is quite incredible. Even Jean talking about reconciling issues of identity and colorism and race. Claude McKay taking a different approach to that very same subject. These are some of the people, and of course, I'm in the service of a foundation under the names of Richard Wright. Approaches to creating worlds, creating narrative, mm-hmm. telling stories, telling history. Mm-hmm. I think in all of this, the point is in the care and creativity for Black people, about Black people, there's a really large, powerful, cogent speaking to humanity across the globe. And before we leave this period, particularly the Harlem Renaissance and this counterculture is very inclusive. Queer people have such important roles to play in moving, not only preserving and thriving in their own lives, but moving us forward. That is an unfair condensation and an unfair bridging for you. But with about 6 to 8 minutes left, we're going to have to figure out how we get through Allen Ginsberg, his personal poetry, the homosexuality, the anti-war commitments, Timothy Leary, I mentioned the Summer of Love earlier, and then finally winding up to Amiri Baraka and Black nationalism. Can we do that? Can we begin to do that?
Yeah. So, I think that in many ways, Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg, the great poet from Paterson, New Jersey, represents a kind of continuation of many of the themes that the counterculture expresses, but also a break from it. So, for instance, he's influenced by Emma Goldman. His father writes in a magazine that publishes many Village Bohemians. Ginsberg himself is deeply interested in jazz and the blues. He too, like Langston Hughes, goes to Columbia University. So there is this kind of really interesting connection between all these figures. At the same time, Ginsberg is much more interested in expressing a kind of sense of self that explodes boundaries. He is seen by critics to be a kind of 20th century Walt Whitman. But what is remarkable about Ginsberg is that he is actively involved in many of the pressing questions and movements of the day, whether it's gay liberation, whether it is the anti-war movement, whether it's the women's movement. And Ginsberg himself is willing to take up this public presence and persona to be at the forefront of these ideals. And at the same time, Ginsberg has personal demons that he fails to grapple with. He is not always sympathetic to women in his midst. For instance, Diane de Prima, who's an incredibly talented poet. Ginsberg, too, is interested in promoting a very specific type of bohemian aesthetic that centers white men at its heart. And this, in part, is one of the reasons why a close friend of his, an early bohemian, Leroy Jones, who comes to be known as Amiri Baraka, engages in a decisive break with Ginsberg. Baraka, who is born in New York, just a couple miles away from Paterson, around the same age as Ginsberg, goes to Rutgers, eventually moves on to Howard University. And throughout his life, he is interested in many of the same themes as Ginsberg. And yet, Ginsberg doesn't fully consider the question of race and white supremacy. which for Baraka is absolutely essential. And so at first, Baraka is involved in the village bohemian scene. But as he starts to recognize that the Beats are not fully committed to Black liberation, and that there needs to be a distinct aesthetic that captures the complexity of Black life and Black experience, he himself moves in a completely different direction. And what he becomes the inspiration for is what comes to be known as the Black Arts Movement, which is a distinctly Black aesthetic that tries to think about politics from a countercultural perspective.
And the further extension of that in all its intersectionality would be Audre Lorde. So I'm going to do you a favor, Alex. I mentioned her as a touch point, but also have us wind up with at 1520 Sedgwick Avenue, if you please.
Yeah. And so the shift from the Beats to the Black Arts Movement to Black feminism ultimately gets us to 1520 Sedgwick, as you point out, David, which is the birth of hip hop. And what's fascinating about this particular apartment and this particular night, it's a dance party hosted by DJ Kool Herc, who essentially tries to spin his way into the future at a moment when the South Bronx is being gentrified, at a moment when the South Bronx is experiencing economic devastation and racism. And in many ways, as we've been seeing throughout history, it's at these moments of crisis, uncertainty, that countercultures form. And it's on Sedgwick Avenue when hip hop is born. And hip hop, as we all know, begins to define the next 50 years of American culture.
And of course, is if not a direct connection, an interesting correlate with the movement for Black Lives, the Black Lives Matter movement, which brings us to today with all the contradictions and attacks and questions that we posed through this historical overview.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that you see that legacy over the last 50 years, where hip hop, in moving from the margins to the mainstream, has also experienced many of the things that counterculture throughout history has.
Yeah, it's co-option, redefinition, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. But at the same time, there are embers and flames, which we see that have a life of their own, that eventually come into specific movements like Black Lives Matter, where that hip hop flame of resisting police brutality, speaking against white supremacy and racism, speaking against economic inequality, all of that remains and is resignified and repurposed by young people today.
And on that note, Alex Zamelin, I want to thank you. Again, we've been speaking to Alex Zamelin. Dr. Zamelin is a professor of Africana Studies and Political Science at Rutgers University, New Brunswick, and the author of Counterculture, The Story of America from Bohemia to Hip Hop.
Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate you having me on.
Oh, you're more than welcome to it. Perhaps we should do a part two and do some Absolutely. More justice to the more current movements.
Absolutely.
Listeners, I, along with probably most of you, are very sad at the transition of Roberta Flack 2 days ago. The daughter of North Carolina, but the adopted daughter of Washington, D.C., R&B and soul and all sorts of music would not be the same. We're going to dearly miss her. My condolences to her family. Thank you, Mike Nicella, our engineer, and to the News and Public Affairs Department, the WPFW. Coming up next, don't forget the Blues with Clarence the Blues Man Turner, and at 1 o'clock, Africa Now with host Moulisa Mutale, and probably a focus on the Democratic Republic of the Congo today. So without further ado, I wish you well, and hopefully we'll meet again on the radio. Take care.
Trains go by. Hello, I'm Von Martin, host of Caribbeana here on Saturdays, 6 p.m. until 9 p.m. on WPFW. For the 48 years I've been on WPFW Radio, I do feel so humbled with the response of you, our listening audience, with your wonderful reaction to our fundraising efforts. On behalf of the staff and management and the volunteers who continue to bring you excellent programming of jazz and jazz extensions with strong public affairs and relevant news, I say thank you. It is such a wonderful reality as we embrace this changing world to be kept abreast and in tune with what is so relevant to our lives and your awareness upkeep. Stay tuned, keep hope alive, and keep listening to us on WPFW, Washington, D.C.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood, visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world in commemoration of International Women's Day. The programming will center the voices of women and girls protecting their communities and resisting imperialism, racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood. Visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
All people in the United States have rights, regardless of immigration status. Knowing our rights is the first step to keeping us safe against the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, or other law enforcement violators of our rights as citizens and immigrants. Guide to protect your rights. 1. Identify emergency contacts and memorize their numbers. 2. Stay calm if approached by ICE or other law enforcement. Do not run, argue, resist, or fight. 3. You have the right to remain silent. 4. You have the right to speak to a lawyer and don't sign anything until you discuss it with a lawyer. 5. If at home, you have the right to refuse entry unless presented with a judicial warrant signed by a judge. An ICE warrant does not allow entry into your home. 6. You have the right to an interpreter. WPFW, defending hard-won human rights, building a more just world, one broadcast at a time.
On Thursday, February 27th, the Howard University Department of Political Science and Howard U. Kwame Ture Society present the event Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, with veteran Black Panther Party member, Black Liberation Army leader, and former political prisoner Daruba Bin-Wahad, who will deliver an analysis on how today's resurgent right-wing agenda is an outgrowth of the ongoing and historical political struggle and what fight-back strategies should look like. That's Revolution in These Times, a Black Liberation Book Talk, Thursday, February 27th, 6 to 8 p.m. in the Howard University's Douglas Hall, Room 221, at 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest, D.C. More information and registration for this event can be found on the webpage, daruba@howard.eventbrite.com. That's D-H-O-R-U-B-A howard.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant.